This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Do you have a point of sale system you can trust, or is it a real POS? You need Shopify for retail. From accepting payments to managing inventory, Shopify POS has everything you need to sell in person. Go to shopify.com/system, all lowercase, to take your retail business to the next level today. That's shopify.com/system.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Predictive algorithms are changing the world. That's the claim of Christopher E. Mason, who's co-authored The Age of Prediction, Algorithms, AI, and the Shifting Shadows of Risk. And he joins me now. So welcome to you.
Oh, thanks for having me. A pleasure to be here.
And I say you co-authored this, and you are a geneticist, and I think your co-author, Igor Tulchinsky, is sort of an expert in finance. So can we just get your bit of it first? What is your expertise in genetics?
So I'm basically a clinical geneticist as well as a researcher in understanding how genes change in three contexts. So the first is in disease, like in cancer, or when things go wrong with an infection at our hospital. And also, we do the second areas in computational methods, so new algorithms and machine learning and AI tools to learn from data, from imaging data, sequence data, medical data. And the third part of our laboratory is to build synthetic biology, so using computational and prediction tools to design new kinds of cells, new kinds of microbial mixtures, and basically new kinds of biology.
So can you put that into context for us in this world of genetics that's now out there in the last, 20, 30 years? How do your activities fit in with what everyone else is doing? What is the range of activity?
Yeah, a lot of it is with sequencing. We do we characterize differences in people who have a mutation or people who have a disease or, again, have an infection or if they go to space. We try to use sequencing-based methods or genetic tools that let us look at the code of life that's mediating a response to a stress, like whether you're getting chemotherapy or if you're in space, or even if we're trying to design a new kind of microbial mixture that could survive on the moon.
Hang on, if you're going into space, where does the role of genetics come into that?
Because when you go into space, actually you see your immune system changes, genes change their expression, so what gets activated in your cells. The genetic tools let us see at a molecular level what's happening inside the body and help us prepare for longer missions like to Mars.
I see. So that's one of the insights we've gained, over the last 10, 15 years, that it's not just what genes you've got, it's which ones are active.
Yeah, that's right. And they're very dynamic and very plastic. And as you can imagine, for example, when you eat spicy food, when you go for a workout and you think, how do you get bigger muscles? Like a lot of that is evidenced by the fact that, a lot of that dynamicism is evidenced by the fact that we have the same DNA in all of our cells, but obviously we have different kinds of cells and they respond differently if you want to get bigger muscles or if you take a drug, So this sort of plasticity and dynamicism of the genetic code is something that we've finally begun to understand for disease, but also for just health and wellness.
Right. And now tell us about your co-author. Where does finance come into this?
So what's exciting about this, Igor Tulchinsky is a friend and colleague. We've been chatting for years about the overlap between different kinds of algorithms in finance and in genetics. And basically that there is these weird parallels where we realize we're using some of the same tools, the same, literally even the same formula sometime to describe economic change versus what's happening in a microbial genome. So some of the same toolboxes, like the Gini coefficient is one where you look at heterogeneity and differences in income. But we use literally the same formula to look at DNA samples that have been sequenced. So we just kept having lunches and dinners and realizing there's a lot of interesting overlaps of the computational tools and the formulas and the methods in quantitative finance and quantitative biology. And so we wanted to write a book about that.
Yeah, that's interesting. And so how did you plan that? I mean, you can say these things have things in common, but how did you plan the book then to make something of that insight?
Well, it started first to put the book, it was over some drinks and some dinners and brainstorming. But we kept thinking, that we wanted to highlight the fact that it's not just, genetics and medicine and finance and quants where we see this. We realized that AI tools and predictive algorithms have really embedded almost every facet of our lives. This includes, economic measurements. I talked about a little bit on the broad scale, about politics, how we do elections. We looked at the military and how they're using AI.
looked at, you know, ways you can monitor whole ecosystems. You know, so really almost everything has been impacted by AI. And so we want to kind of call this the age of prediction, because it is a new era where predictive algorithms and AI is really not just a feature of life. It is a fundamental, you know, I think, you know, pillar of existence at this point.
Yeah, so we're going to go through some of those examples. You just ran through some of them then. But just first of all, in terms of the power of predictive algorithms, if you were trying to convince someone of just how astonishing this all is now, what example would you come up with?
I think one of the most, approximately the one that's most striking is the ability to shift people's perceptions on Facebook. So kind of really even not quite mind control, but you can control a bit of what was called social contagion, which I wrote about in the book, is that you can move people's systems of kind of reaction and emotion and belief even. That's on a subtle level, because it affects billions of people because Facebook was so large, for example. But on a very precise level, also just the precision warfare tools can do, you know, machine learning for specific faces and lead to a way to really, target only a single individual or you know, some group of people or family or even ethnicity we talk about in the book. You can target people from a certain background with a lot of these tools. So on a very darker side, you could actually have, you know, more precise warfare and unfortunately killing. But we also talk about the shifting shadows of risk in the book, is that is more precise and it's killing people. But you could also argue it kills less of the unintended people, that you're not killing as many other non-combatants or not killing the wrong person if you're trying to, say, assassinate someone. So there's a bit of a pros and cons. Yeah.
When you say killing people, you're talking about the use of algorithms in military contexts.
It's very much in that context. Yeah.
Okay, so well, let's just go through the Facebook one, which is sort of, as you say, quite striking and even frightening. So, can you give an example of the most effective use of algorithms to shift? Can you say beliefs through social media?
Yeah, the term social contagion is what was put forward by sociologists, and this came from the Cambridge Analytica discussion that was very controversial because it was potentially impacting on what people would see and think about where they could go vote or what they should believe about what's true even. And so social media, you know, originally was supposed to, I think, bring us all together, because you could have this great open realm where anyone could talk to anybody and we could all learn from each other and share data and methods. But it also was a place where misinformation and disinformation, of course, have propagated. And so the Cambridge Analytica, it's been discussed multiple times. We talk about it in the book, is that some people say, well, it didn't do that much. It only nudged a few people here and there. Others think it definitely shifted the 2016 election, for example. That it was really dramatic. But from people that have interviewed, that I've interviewed, it definitely, for at least some people, had dramatic impacts on their mood and what they would see and then what they would believe. That has been well documented and published, what was called social contagion. And I think it is, in some ways, is almost, it's just irresistible from some social scientist perspective, because suddenly you could manipulate basically billions of people at a time, which normally you can only have 10 or 20 people for a study. So it was ostensibly done just for the sake of science and understanding how emotions move through networks. But it had the unintended result of, doing a large scale experiment on people who didn't consent for that experiment. So.
That's right. I mean, that was the Cambridge Analytica story, really, wasn't it? They used to get, I think, some messaging down to groups of a few hundred people, even on Facebook, getting their profile exactly right for the different messages. That was a while ago now. It's almost, getting on for 10 years ago. So when you look at the future of this, where's that gone now? Where's it heading, that use of social media to change people's views?
Yeah, so now it's come, Facebook has come back down a little bit, I think, on, or at least what they've said that they're doing, is they're no longer doing this as much to move people's emotions and change their, essentially their behavior. But the network is still there, and it's not the only one. I think so. While I think it may have been attenuated and reduced a bit on Facebook, there is, of course, Twitter, or which now X, which has its own social network, or LinkedIn, other networks. Look at TikTok, look at WhatsApp even. There's many, many platforms on which there's, hundreds of millions or billions of people not operating. And so we know that they're consistently monitored, and the algorithms have to be used to just track the data. So it is an ongoing, I think, effort of a balance, really, of enabling freedom on those platforms, but controlling misinformation, which is inevitable. At some point, you have to decide, well, this is, you know, a Holocaust denier or someone, so we should not let that propagate because it's not true. But then at some point, you need a group of people saying, we have to decide what else is not going to be expanded or amplified, and that inevitably has to be done on these big platforms.
No, you need big editors. That's right. Yeah. But just to, no, what I was really asking was that Cambridge Analytica, I guess, had a breakthrough moment, you know, when they realized the power of this technology and used it for the first time, and it made a huge impact. I was really asking, has the technology moved on since then? Have they, or is it just little refinements and tweaks, really, since then?
Yeah, so it's, if anything, I think it's gotten much better. It's gotten even more precise in terms of the targeting. But I think there's been nothing as dramatic as what if we could change the course of an election that has occurred, since then. Also, people are now more aware of it. So I think people are paying attention. People have a keen sense of the power of AI. So I think it's no longer kind of in the background. It's now in the front of everyone's brain space to think about this.
Right. So let's get another area, which I guess is related, but predictions of voting patterns. Is that relying on that Cambridge Analytica technology, or is that something else?
The Cambridge Analytica was one of the first ones, but there's other companies that do this and other algorithms, some of which are not public, that do kind of the same data mining to look for patterns and then try and predict how you could.
Yeah, so that's the same area, really. About vaccines? And you talk about the creation of vaccines. How does AI help with that?
So what's extraordinary, and this is one of the opening parts of the book, is because you can predict, essentially, instead of looking at one molecule of RNA, you can look at really almost every molecule that's ever been observed and use that to predict what would be the best place to actually modify an RNA for vaccine development or even for a cancer trials, actually also being there. So to take a step back, what we talk about in the book is, you know, what happened when, of course, SARS-CoV-2 came into the world and we realized in early 2020 we were getting into a pandemic. Within a matter of days, actually, the founders of BioNTech used an algorithm to compare the sequence of the newly found virus to every known other virus that they've been looking at and find the best way it would fold and which sequence they could use and which modifications would be required to build the mRNA vaccine. And it was done, you know, in a matter of days. And by the previous record holder for a vaccine development was a matter of years, or sometimes it would take decades to really do an attenuation of a virus before you could use it as a vaccine. And so it really, you know, it's leaps and bounds and orders of magnitude faster to see a sequence compared to the totality of all known genetic information about other viruses, then design a vaccine and then deploy it all within, you know, really 3-4 months.
And when you talk about all that data, how is it that drugs companies get access to that data?
So a lot of it's public. So one good thing is the majority, I'd say, of sequence data is, you know, from academic sites or companies that look at a question, publish a paper, get the result, and then they make all the data available. So it's all publicly and freely available.
Yeah. Other areas, you talked about smart, you know, weapons, and there's a lot of artificial intelligence in robotic weapons and so on. What is the latest technology they're doing?
In any context or in particular, I guess, anywhere?
Well, in the AI, what can... If you were sitting in, I'll ask the question again. Let's just talk about another area. If you were in the Pentagon and you were looking at AI and you had a department there, presumably they do, what AI can deliver for, let's say, the American military, what areas are the most striking there?
So there it is, the precision bombs, precision warfare, the facial recognition software, and also a lot of the satellite data. So to a large degree, they're monitoring at high resolution almost every site around the world, frankly. So this is the ability to predict, you know, where tanks are moving, where people are going. So, of course, what happened recently with the Hamas attack in Israel, just because you have lots of cameras and tools and AI platforms, you know, doesn't mean you'll see everything that's coming, because clearly that didn't happen for that attack. But it is that idea, though, that you could see as things are moving in place, you can tell before any attack occurs, you know, that it's about to happen.
Yeah, it sounds like one of those cases of life imitating art. I think you've got a lovely cat in the background, haven't you?
Just moved her out. Yeah, that's right.
No problem. It's a bit like life imitating art in that you see these movies where, you know, the all-seeing camera identifies someone by facial recognition, you know, anywhere on Earth, and the spy agency knows exactly where everyone is. And you're saying basically that is happening.
Yeah, it is unquestionably, it's here. Let's see, again, it seems like something out of a movie or science fiction, but it's already happening.
Yeah, and I know in Afghanistan, the Americans were taking, I think they were taking DNA of all the Afghan prisoners they got, weren't they? So that they had an amazing data bank of that.
Yeah, and the Uyghur Muslims and some of the Chinese in the northern part of China were being also samples being taken and collected by the Chinese government. So this idea of sort of tracking, we have a whole section on forensics in the book, you know, a whole idea of tracking people anywhere they leave DNA or when they go through a checkpoint and collect a sample, you know, it sounds like something out of a dystopian movie or novel, but it's already happening, right? There are ongoing collections without really a lot of consent or control of the data that are happening as we speak.
Well, you've used the word dystopian. So when you know, saw the whole range of activity that's going on, and you've just described three or four, you know, pretty remarkable applications of this, what scared you most, actually?
I think, you know, because I'm an optimist by general. So there's some things that could feel dystopian, and we try to write in the book all the cases where even if something is worse on one hand, it might be better another. But I think the thing that, you know, the thing that scares me the most, I think, is potentially, you know, actually the disinformation is probably the thing that scares me the most, which you might be surprised by, because you could think you could have technologies that make like a super bug. You can make, you know, all this technology to make a vaccine you could use to make a super virus and have a bioterrorism event. Or you could design an AI system that would be self-aware and say, I'm going to kill all of humanity, and someone could make that as a terrorist or just as a crazy person. And so those are two things people often point to as bioterrorism and AI are existential threats that could lead to a dystopian world. But I actually think that the disinformation and misinformation is so subversive and sticky that that it's actually, I think, even more nefarious and hard to get rid of, and could lead to a dystopia where no one believes anything anymore that they read because they've been lied to too many times. And you know, if that does happen, why would you believe anything someone sends you? Because you've been lied to. So, you know, other things like aggressive AI, I think we could have benevolent AI, or, you know, bioterrorism, we could, you know, have bio surveillance and bio resistance that we can defend against it. But I think misinformation gets stuck in people's heads and it's hard to dislodge.
Well, it's very interesting you say it's sticky. I mean, I totally agree with you that it's so profound, isn't it? That if people just believe basically almost what they want to believe, and they consider it to be true and unshakably true, I mean, it does undermine virtually everything about Western liberalism and our way of life, doesn't it?
Yeah. Well, because an informed populace is what you need to help guide policy, voting, just rationality. And if they're, you know, it's like we laugh and say, oh, flat earthers are ridiculous, right? But what if suddenly 20% of people thought they were flat earthers and they would say, well, we don't need a space program, or satellites aren't real, or, you know, like there could be devastating consequences to people who believe things that are, you know, falsifiable and just not sane.
This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Do you have a point of sale system you can trust, or is it a real POS? You need Shopify for retail. From accepting payments to managing inventory, Shopify POS has everything you need to sell in person. Go to shopify.com/system, all lowercase, to take your retail business to the next level today. That's shopify.com/system.
Now, it's interesting you use the word sticky, because I mean, I did quite a lot of work on radicalization of violent jihadis.
And, yeah.
You know, just because I was a sort of correspondent in all that at the time. And what I discovered going to those de-radicalization camps was that you could persuade someone to be a suicide bomber even quite easily, but you could also persuade them to stop quite easily. It was it was a very surprising thing that, you know, but these people
were so flippable, right? Yeah.
It was quite biddable, you know, and they could be talked into something or talked out of it. But you're saying that's not really the case with this disinformation. It's sticky. Tell us a bit about that.
Yeah, so it is. I mean, so I agree. There is some hope that if someone can quickly be convinced to be a suicide bomber, maybe they could very quickly go back, right? So that is a hopeful view. But I think the challenge is also in the context. Like, if everyone around them is also thinking that this is a good idea, it's hard to dislodge that. You know, I think that stickiness component is not just within a person; it's within a community, within a culture. And so I think, you know, it does mean it's not permanent, though, right? And just the same way, you know, slavery used to be viewed as just normal, Of course, it's abhorrent, and no one would think otherwise. But I think there's evidence that people, even if something is pervasive and sticky and immoral, it might take time, but it is possible, I think, to remove it even on a large scale sense.
But maybe what you've just said is quite an important insight, that it's not quite as scary as you think, in that you get sort of 4 billion people each believing their own thing. Because you get groups of people, and peer pressure matters.
I mean, because there's really no the guiding force between all the cultures of the nations, right? So the United Nations is kind of doing this, but it is, trying to coordinate between many nations, but it is still really a nation by nation and culture by culture dynamic, or at least it has been. But if you think about what we have today, though, no one thinks twice about doing a Zoom or a WhatsApp or calling someone across the world. I can pick up the call, someone that's in China, literally across the world, and I don't even think twice about it. And so I think, and this global communication system hasn't really existed until the past, 20, 25 years. Before then there were wires, there was mail, but everything was pretty slow and disconnected, disjointed, and certainly not as fast. So I think this new era, the era of prediction, this era of rapid communication, it will maybe make it possible so we could start to move faster towards these more benevolent states, because people have more access to information. It just has to be clean, though, from the disinformation. That's my biggest fear.
Right. Well, if you were thinking, if you were George Orwell writing 1984 today, and you were thinking, not so much about TVs in every room and the sort of kind of propaganda he had in mind, but by this post-truth world and the ability to use social media to make people believe things, I guess you'd have the hero who resisted it, and that raises the question of how much of these AI prediction techniques are gameable by humans, and that they can predict themselves what's they're gonna do and sort of frustrate the AI. How real is all that?
I think it's very real, because AI is like any technology, right? It can be a tool or it can be a weapon, depending on how you hold it. And if people are building, counteracting or countermeasures to some of the AI tools out there, they will, they'll just as many of them being built, or even like what are called the white hat hackers versus black hat hackers. I think writ large for most technologies like this, like you could just argue like hacking and network security is itself almost a tool. And are there more black hat hackers or malevolent hackers, or are there more white hat hackers, people that are trying to, be benevolent? And there's actually more of the good kind. So I think if you look in other places where technology exists, or for example, synthesis of dangerous RNA viruses, which, could potentially lead to like a spillover event, but could help us better understand a dangerous pathogen. So basically, I think there's more of the good than the bad. So I think with AI technology, I anticipate we'll see the same kind of distribution.
There's another whole area which is interesting, which is insurance and how it's possible it's going to be now to predict illnesses and all that, because that has quite that could be you're saying that the post-truth stuff really could affect the world, vaccines really could affect the world, but so could this predictability of a human life, isn't it?
Yeah. Well, and are you closer to are you high risk, low risk? Where are you at in your risk profile? And we talk a little bit in the book, because some of this is, we a lot of people don't think twice about it. Like when, for example, we got new car insurance, part of the deal was you'll get a little better rate if you let them put a little tracker in your car that can tell how fast you're going, where you drive, what you do, your behavior, which is on the face of it seems okay. But my wife was like, we're not putting that in our car. I'd rather pay a higher rate and have people not know what we're doing, because she was just creeped out by it. So I think, we quantify everything from car insurance to health insurance to your genetic risk to when you might likely die. And it does have consequences for your family, too, because you share, of course, like 50% of your DNA with your siblings or with your parents, or 25% with your grandparents, or 12.5% with your cousins. So if you post on like Facebook or on X and say, oh, I got just diagnosed with breast cancer and I have a BRCA1 mutation, that means an insurance company could look at that and say, oh, well, since we know you carry a lot of the same genetic code as that person, we're going to raise your rates. And that would be perfectly legal to do today. Not necessarily the best model, but certainly perfectly legal to do so.
So do you think insurance long term is something that just won't work, because this whole idea of pooling risk won't really work when you actually know what the risk is for an individual?
No, it would work if the system is balkanized not that well, I'd say. But what you could imagine, if you would have a centralized healthcare system where everyone has healthcare, then it would be great, because you could better track models of risk and then intervene earlier. But if it's a for-profit healthcare system and everyone's not sharing information, then you will, it will not work. It'll be awful, or it'll be work in a pretty nefarious and I think kind of brutal way.
Yeah, it's interesting you say that because the socialized health system, which we've got in the UK, should deliver that kind of benefit and indeed lots of preventative medicine, because there's obviously the whole system's got an interest in preventing expensive serious illness later.
Exactly.
But for some reason, it doesn't work. And I think just the financial pressures are too great to. Yeah, they're always dealing with today's crisis rather than preventing tomorrow's.
Yeah. Well, that's just what they've gotten used to, basically. I'd say, yeah.
And budgets, but yeah. Anyway, So.
But they could change. They could change if they really wanted to. I think it's still a chance to change and change to get better.
Yeah. So, as you look ahead to all this, what's going to change in the next 10 years? Quickest. What can we expect?
So I think I had a book called The Next 500 Years, which I wrote about a longer term plan. But I think in the next 10 years, we'll see that this the current pace of AI deployment will accelerate. We'll see more of it in more places. I think a lot of it will lead to more convenience. You could see better healthcare. You could see better just even a faster pickup time if you order a Lyft or an Uber car, because it's building a lot of tools in there. You'll see better returns for finance because we're getting better at squeezing more out of every dollar to have it be reinvested and make more money for the market, which is good for people's retirement funds. So there's some good things I think that will hopefully get better. And I think though that we'll know if certainly 10 years from now, if this spooky risk of a self-aware AI that could be a threat to all of humanity, if it really becomes, if it really is true, and I don't think it will be. I think will be tempered by the benefits of time, seeing that, actually the world didn't end, because everyone who said the world's going to end ever has been wrong consistently. And I think so that'll be good to see, as my guess, that the world will not have ended in 10 years. But also some of the AI tools, for example, for image recognition will improve diagnostics at hospitals. There'll be entirely new means and speed with which we find and cure disease. We'll use AI algorithms to look at image scans of the moon when things land on the moon. Basically, spacecraft will scan the ground automatically to find the best place to land on the moon and eventually Mars. So we'll see AI in all these really wonderful places as well.
Yeah, but I think as your co-author is particularly, really bothered about the implications for free will. And maybe that's more than 10 years, but just take us through the future of that as you see it.
We talked a bit about this because it's an old question. Do we have free will? Do we have determinism? Do we have soft determinism? What is the nature, effectively of consciousness? And do we have, can we make our own choices? And if the algorithms get really good, it will be on some level harder to say, I made that decision. Because if an algorithm could have predicted everything you were going to be doing, and almost perfectly, well then, maybe they could do the decision better than you can, or that you could predict perfectly what you would have done, and you could be modeled so perfectly. So I still think philosophically we may not actually have free will in terms of the understanding of consciousness and neuroscience and just even how it's viewed in philosophy. So that is the common thread now, is that we may not have free will, but then often the final concluding statement is, but it may not matter because it still feels like you do, and we still have to act as if we do. Because if you don't have free will, some people think, well, then I'm not accountable for anything because I didn't do it. But that's not, of course, how we act. You are a collection of everything that's happened to you over time, that you have done, your environment, but all that still comprises you. And even if it could be perfectly modeled by some algorithm, like to the T, it could get you spot on, then it would still feel as if you had free will, and you should still act as if you do because you're still responsible for your actions.
I still get jailed if you do a crime,
right? Yeah, that's right. That's right. You can't say, the algorithm told me to do it, or I'm not responsible because of course society would collapse if we said no one's responsible for anything. We would not be able to actually even have a functioning society.
This is quite probably a bit of an unfair question, but I'm just wondering whether you've seen a work of literature or a film or some creative work which, to your mind, has best expressed these issues you're dealing with.
Well, actually, one of my favorites is The Matrix, the movie from 1999, I believe it is. with Keanu Reeves and Carrie Ann Moss. And so it was a really great, in that case, it was a dystopian movie, but it was a lot about free will, about prediction, about your mind being perfectly modeled and then put into a battery cage. So I really enjoy that movie because it expresses ideas around self, free will, Buddhism, purpose, and also, what is real.
Christopher Mason, fascinating. Thank you very much indeed.
Thank you. A pleasure to be here. And thanks for joining me with my cat.